Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, I have a note here that comes in from Andrew listening in Chicago. It says, Patrick, can you comment on why or why not Christians should or should not impose their morality on non-believers? Is this found anywhere in the Bible? Specifically in regards to the abortion issue. I have Protestant friends who claim Christians should not impose their morality on non-believers via the state, as it will have no effect on anyone's salvation. He also claims that whenever Scripture teaches morality, it is only teaching it to Christians, which further cements his point that Christians should not impose their morality on non-Christians. Thanks. Well, it sounds like your friend might be a little bit muddled in his thinking. Here's how I look at it, Andrew. First of all, as St. Paul says, the law of God is written on everyone's heart. So nobody, whether they believe in God or not, is exempt from knowing at some deep level in your conscience, being aware that certain kinds of activity, behavior, etc., are wrong. So you don't need religion to tell you that murder is wrong. Atheists know that murder is wrong. They know because they know. They know because even though they deny God's existence, God has encoded that or hardwired that into their very being. So we can start there and just say that it's self-evident, with or without belief in God, with or without religion, it's self-evident that certain kinds of behavior are wrong. This is why, in the course of human history, societies have imposed laws to make life a little more livable. Because if there were no laws, if there were no punishments, if there were no deterrents, and anybody could do anything to anybody else at any time with no consequences, you know, we would have destroyed ourselves many times over. So it's a natural human tendency, and it's based upon our own innate awareness of right and wrong and the natural law, which tells us how, among other things, tells us how things should be used and the proper use of things. It is a natural human tendency for us to enact laws and to enforce them. And that's a form of morality. Whether he realizes it or not, all of the laws that we have on the books about, for example, you can't hack into somebody's bank account and steal money. You can't break into somebody's home and steal his lawnmower or hurt him or kill him. You can't do all kinds of things that we freely legislate. And I'm sure your friend is the grateful beneficiary, if he stops and thinks about it, about all those legislated moral precepts. It's not just, hey, we don't like murder. We say murder is wrong. It's evil. It's not that, you know, we just don't like theft. Whether you like it or not is immaterial. The question is theft wrong? This is what I would do if I were you. I would get around this sort of flimsy barrier that he set up for himself to say, well, if you're saying that, you know, Christians cannot, you know, he's saying force their morality or impose their morality. Well, okay, can anyone impose any morality on anybody? Ask that question. Let alone Christians. Well, let's just leave Christians out of this for a minute. Can anyone impose any morality on anybody? And the answer, of course, is yes. And all you have to do is look at the penal code of your country, your state, etc., where certain activities are proscribed. And if you engage in those activities, you will be punished. That's legislating morality against theft and murder, etc. This is like super, super basic and self-evident. And I'm not saying, I'm not talking down to you, but I'm saying I think your friend is probably creating this very subjective and capricious sort of objection. If I had to guess, I guess it may well be because he doesn't want to maybe face himself in the mirror and say that, you know, maybe there is an objective standard of morality that all people are called to observe, Christian or not, because it might interfere with something he's doing that he doesn't want to stop doing. Maybe. I don't know. Possible. But I would talk about that. I would talk with him about what is, how do you know what is right or wrong? How do you know? And once you know it, don't you have a duty to live that way? And if somebody is not living that way, don't you have a duty to try to, yes, to try to impose morality on that person? Not in everything, but in some things. And so in the case of abortion, what is it? That is killing an innocent human being. Life begins at conception. That's a human life. And if you kill this unborn human person, you're killing somebody. And we don't need religion to tell us that that's wrong. God did say that to Moses, thou shalt not kill. But people understood that killing was wrong even before that. Moses, look at him. Long before he got the Ten Commandments, he killed a guy in Egypt. Moses was a murderer. And he ran. He fled Egypt. Why did he flee Egypt? Because he knew that what he did was wrong. And he knew, more importantly, that he was going to get punished for it because the Egyptians knew that it was wrong. And the Catholic Church wasn't there to tell them that it was wrong because people know that instinctively. Yes, God gave him that commandment in the Ten Commandments later on, but it wasn't as though it was necessary. Oh, now I get it. Killing people is wrong because God said so in the Ten Commandments. They already knew that. So my advice, just work with him at that level and start tilling the soil and helping him kind of face up to the fact that this argument that you can't legislate morality is not only is it wrongheaded, but it's also factually incorrect because we live in a society, as all people do in one way or another, where some sort of morality is being imposed on everybody. It may differ from place to place, but it's more or less the same everywhere you go. And then I would go from there. Thanks for the email, 888-914-9149. Back to the phones. Let's go to, where are we going? Bethany in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Bethany.
Hi there. I am just curious about your comments on the separation of church and state. I'm thinking in particular of Pope Gelasius. I'm not sure which one exactly, but from what I understand, he had said that church and state should be separate in order to protect the church from the state, not the other way around.
Well, that, of course, is a matter that many popes have talked about. Pope Pius X, in his Syllabus of Errors, he condemned the radical version of separation of church and state, and he said that the church, by her very nature, has a role to play in society, in civil society, and so he was proposing something that, you know, people today would certainly not recognize, and that is a closer relationship between the church and the state. But that also is presupposing the relationship in Christendom. From an historical standpoint, Christendom was the phenomenon of the intertwining between the Catholic Church and the various kingdoms and empires and nation states, where the two were cohesive and not separated, and very often that resulted in a great benefit to the people. Not always, but often it did. So the separation of church and state in an American 21st century context, not, you know, it's, there's a legal definition to that, and even today people dispute what is the correct understanding of what the Constitution says about the separation of church and state, and using, for example, that the state cannot impose a state religion and so on. I guess what I would say is, living in the context of America as we do, we do the best we can within the framework that we exist in. So we have ideals proposed to us by the church, but sometimes it's impossible to live out those ideals because of the nature of the government or the nature of society. And, you know, this is one reason, if you don't mind a slight digression on your point, Bethany, this is why you may have heard that Justice Clarence Thomas was quoted as saying that, you know, other established court decisions may be up for grabs again, like Obergefell, which is the decision on so-called gay marriage, and other decisions that would touch upon things like contraception, gay marriage. What I foresee as a problem is that if it were to go back, if those kinds of things were to go back to the courts, as much as I would like to see them overturned, I don't know how readily that could be implemented in our already badly distorted and fractured society. So there's maybe, I guess what I'm trying to say here, Bethany, is in addition to the law or the truth or the way in which we should try to live our lives, we also have to deal with the reality of our circumstances and seek the best or the most efficacious way of doing that. And sometimes it's not the ideal, you know. So sometimes it would be like, take for example, I'll give you another example. What about birth control? You know, birth control is seriously sinful, but vast swaths of American society don't believe that. So if the Supreme Court were to adjudicate a case that resulted in, let's just say, a making contraception illegal, I don't think that would be a livable situation in this country because of the nature of the circumstances. And so then the question is it right and appropriate for the Supreme Court in this fictitious scenario to do such a thing, even though the thing itself may be bad? Is it going to create worse and more widespread problems by making that illegal? I think a lot of those are the kinds of situations that we have to look at when we contemplate the church and state and prayer in schools and things of that nature. What are your thoughts?
Okay. Well, I guess one of my questions is then, when is it time for Christians to shake the dust from their feet?
Well, I mean, you can always pack up and move. And I'm not saying that to be flippant. You know, if by shake the dust off your feet, you mean to get up and go, you have that right. You can move to some remote place, move to a different country. I don't know how successful you would be in avoiding some of these same problems that we have here. They're worse in some places. But if that's what you mean by shaking the dust off your feet and moving on, it seems like the answer would be when you find it intolerable, then you go. But think about for a minute, Bethany, I'll leave it at this. Think about the early Christians living in the Roman Empire. They had a pretty bad situation there because the Roman Empire, in its various intermittent persecutions against Christianity, and they would lurch from one persecution to another. It wasn't this continuous persecution. They would flare up and die down. But when they flared up, and the Roman emperor said, check it out, every single person in every single town has to throw a pinch of incense in front of an idol of Caesar to demonstrate that you're one of us. And if you're not willing to do that, we're going to put you to death. So that's a pretty extreme example. And they would roll into town and they'd set up the table in the middle of the forum and everybody would have to come through and throw some incense. They get their little certificate or their name would be recorded even saying, yep, he did it, he did it, he did it. Oh, this one won't do it. Well, if you don't do it, we're going to feed you to the animals. Some people would back down, some people would do it. But there's an example of where, you know, maybe you can't shake the dust from your feet and you can't leave. You just have to live within that situation. And if you get pushed to the point where this is a red line that you can't cross over, because if you do, you wind up denying Christ, then you have to take the consequences. I know, easier said than done. But our Catholic forefathers, right, and Catholic foremothers in the early church did that when they said, I can't do that. I'm not going to throw a pinch of incense on the fire in front of Caesar's idol. And, you know, maybe the procurator would say, oh, don't worry, just pretend. We know you don't really mean it, but just do it anyway, and then you get off the hook. Well, you know, many of them said, I'm sorry, I can't do that because it's not pretend, and I can't cross my fingers. And they had to willingly lay down their lives for Jesus. Sometimes you can't shake the dust from your feet. You've got to stand and deal with the consequences. And I hope we don't get to that point here.
Okay, thank you for your comments.
You're welcome. I hope I didn't overwhelm you with my deluge of verbiage. But it's an important question. We should all think about that. Remember what Jesus said, if you are faithful in little things, you'll be faithful in big things. So if you keep the 1 hour fast before receiving Holy Communion, that's a little thing. But if you're faithful to that, if you're faithful to, say, not eat meat on Fridays, all Fridays throughout the year, or if you have an occasion to eat meat, you substitute it with another penance. This is part of the church's law. It hasn't been abrogated. Vatican II didn't do away with that. That's a little thing. If you are faithful in the duties of your state and life, as a husband or a wife, you know. What happens is, it's like lifting weights. The more you lift those weights, the more strength accrues to your muscles. And you get to the point where you can easily lift things, especially heavier things, because you have been steadily building, building, building. And that's the way virtue is. That's, I think, what Jesus is referring to when he says, if you're faithful in little things, you'll be faithful in big things. The little things would be fidelity in those little things day to day. But what happens is you're building a stable disposition of virtue so that when a big temptation comes, or there's a big crisis where you're being asked to do something that you know that you can't do, and if you did do it, it would be a serious sin, you're going to be able to withstand those bigger temptations because you have been building those muscles little by little all along on those little things. Something we should all contemplate, if you ask me. Let's go to Rocio in Mission, Texas. Hi, Rocio.
Hi, Patrick. My question was about my pastor was preach on regarding second reading on the Galatians about the marks of Jesus on his body. Okay. And my pastor said on his homily that that statement may represent another argument to consider tattooing a sinful action. I don't have any plan to get a tattoo, but I consider that my pastor was saying was come from his opinion more than from the magisterium of the church says. So
what was his opinion?
Tattooing.
What was his opinion?
His opinion was that the tattoos are more to please our ego, and that's why it's a sinful action. I haven't found anything on the catechism or on media or anything. So I was looking. I found even tattoo priests, but nothing that it says tattooing is a sin.
Right. The church,
I'm very nervous. I'm sorry for my voice.
Oh, it's okay. Don't worry. Don't be nervous. So I can say this much. The church does not have a teaching per se that getting tattoos is bad. It doesn't say that. And we have latitude. You know, and people have there's a difference of opinion on this issue. But I think what your priest was driving at is certainly true, and that is if the motivation to get a tattoo is vanity, then yes, that can easily be sinful, because vanity, keep in mind, is a form of pride, and pride is the chief of the capital sins. You have lust and gluttony and wrath, etc., but pride is at the very top. In fact, pride in a way is the root of all the other capital sins. And so if that's what the priest was referring to, he's absolutely correct that it can be a sin because it's vanity. And you'll notice, at least I've noticed, but you know, it seems to me that most people who have tattoos, they wear clothing so that you'll see the tattoo because they want you to admire it. And I'm thinking, oddly enough, of the takedown of the young man that killed all those people in suburban Chicago just this past weekend, you know, the mass shooting that was done there.
Uh-huh.
And there's a very interesting photograph, and it jumped out at me right away. There are like five or six law enforcement guys, police, sheriffs, whoever, and they're all wearing long pants, and they're all apprehending this guy. And there's one guy, and everybody in the picture, their back is facing, so you're looking at their backs because they're looking toward the guy that they're getting. There's this one guy who's wearing shorts, and he's got a big tattoo on the calf of his right leg. So when I saw that, I thought, you know, it's a warm day, summertime. There's nothing unusual about somebody wearing shorts. But it was interesting to me to see that all the other law enforcement guys were dressed in uniform with, you know, and the guy who had the shorts didn't look like an undercover guy. He looked like he too was wearing, at least on his torso, a uniform. He had a hat. He had the belt and all that. But he was wearing shorts. And my initial reaction is because he wanted people to see his tattoo. So this is just an observation that goes to the point of what you're asking about. I would agree with the priest that if getting a tattoo is rooted in pride in the form of vanity and wanting people to look at you and admire you, you'll see a lot of times that guys who are very muscular and ripped because they're in the gym and they're pumping iron, all that, very often they want to wear shirts with either very short sleeves or no sleeves at all because they want to show those guns off. and they want people to see them. So the church doesn't say you can't get a tattoo, but what the church does say is examine your motives and think really carefully about what marking your body like this is, where is this coming from, and then make your decision accordingly. I have to take a break. I hope that's helpful. Now, there is a resource that you can check out. I'm going to retweet it. It's an article written by a deacon from the Archdiocese of Portland, Oregon. It's called Tattoo You. And you can get that in PDF form. Go to my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
That's all I get. Just, she didn't say much.
Let's get to the song.
That's true.
Rocking.
It is. I used to listen to this on the radio when I was a kid. Okay, 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Dennis in Bloomfield, New Jersey. Good morning, Dennis.
Oh, good morning. Yes, Patrick. Yeah. As I came to mind thinking about the decision by the Supreme Court, the question of personhood, was that ever, was I read somewhere that would be a very important question to be addressed? Was it? And if so, why not? And would it be possibly in the future for it to be brought up?
Are you referring to Roe versus Wade or to the Dobbs decision?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, that's a question. It's a very good question. I don't have an answer for it, though, because I didn't finish reading the opinion. It was 100 pages, single-spaced, very dense information, and I just haven't had a chance to read it. I mean, I skimmed it here and there, but it may well have a section on that. I just don't know for sure, and I don't know what was said.
Yeah, just how would that affect as far as the real ruling itself as the importance of recognizing personhood of a fetus, whether that, right. How significant that would be.
Yeah, knowing what I think I know about the opinions of the majority on the court on this topic, I would think that it would be strange if it weren't present in that decision. But I don't want to tell you something that I haven't checked on for myself. But you know, the nice thing is it's available out there easily, and you can search it on a PDF form and find the answer to that question. I should do the same thing. I just haven't looked for it yet.
Okay. Well, thanks, Patrick. Yeah. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for the call. Let's go now to Gloria in Laguna Hills, California. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, Patrick. I'm so proud of my sister calling you earlier to ask you the question that I was confused about as well. Uh-huh. I thought you had to go to a brick and mortar. This is regarding the Blessed Mother's devotion to the Blessed Mother, the first five Saturdays.
Okay.
And I thought that you had to go to a brick and mortar Saturday morning mass, that the televised version was not valid, and the rebroadcast to me was not valid either, because she's in New York. That's a 5 o'clock mass, and my mass is at 9 o'clock, and I listen to you on the app all the time.
Thank you.
I have a second question too after that.
Before we get to that second question, I see now a piece of the puzzle that I didn't see when I talked to your sister, and that is it escaped my notice that she, I don't remember her saying that it was Mass on TV. That part I didn't catch.
Yeah, it was Mass on TV.
See, I thought she was referring to going to Mass on Saturday or at least receiving the Holy Eucharist on Saturday, and that's where I mentioned that the rubric says you have 24 hours on either side, but it didn't. So it didn't click with me that she was talking about Mass on TV. So, yeah, I would agree with you that that doesn't fulfill the devotion. So if you're going to Mass, if you're observing Mass on television, it's very good, but it's not the same thing as being at Mass.
And she does go to the brick and mortar at 4:30 in the afternoon, but that's her Sunday obligation, not Saturday.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter?
No.
So
no.
They both count. So
oh, yeah. Sure. Now, so just to be clear, watching Mass on TV would not count, would not fulfill the requirements for that devotion. But going to Mass on Saturday, even though it's the vigil Mass for Sunday and fulfilling your Sunday obligation, that certainly would count.
Okay, well, that's a good thing. The second question I have for you, Patrick, I've listened to you for a long time.
Thank you.
Since coming back to the church in 2010. So
thank you.
My sister is recent. She's just in the last 2 years, I think. And I've talked with her endlessly about you. And the second question is, when are you going to get to New York, where there are so many pagans? They're surrounding her. They absolutely envelop her. It's like, oh, that poor child. I do the best I can of regurgitating what you say, but it's not the same thing as your calm, peaceful, wonderful voice explaining everything in detail. It's so difficult, you know, and I do play it for her periodically, depending on what the issue is.
Well, you know, if she doesn't live, you're probably listening on 9:30 a.m., right? 93 KHJ?
Yes, 93 or 1,000 in the car, depending on where the heck I am.
Okay, that's our San Diego station down there. I'm so glad you have stations in your backyard. Does she not have a relevant station where she lives?
She doesn't. Cherry Valley is like in farmland north of Cooperstown. Yeah. The closest city is Albany.
Okay.
But I don't.
Well, we have. Oh, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you. We have a list of all of our stations, both owned and affiliate stations throughout the country, a total of about 200 of them, at relevantradio.com. So anybody who's listening to us right now, Gloria, who's wondering, do I have a station near me? Just go there, relevantradio.com, click on listen, and you'll see our map of stations. But the easy way around this, Gloria, would be encourage your sister to put the Relevant Radio app on her phone, if she has a smartphone or a tablet, or she could always... She could always click on the link for Relevant Radio's website, relevantradio.com, and then she can listen to her heart's content, and she can listen to whatever she might have missed whenever she wants to.
I know, that's what I do, and I've been working on her about that, but she doesn't do it because it's expensive.
Well, the app is
she's
free.
She's 81 years old.
Yeah, the app is free.
She's 81 years old.
Yeah. So, Gloria, I think you said you had another question, is that right?
That was the second question. When are you going to get to that area? So,
well, Relevant Radio, I can tell you this much. Relevant Radio is always seeking to expand, and whenever God gives us an opportunity and opens a door for us to expand into another area, we try to do that. So if God opens those doors, then you can be sure we will have a presence there in due time.
Okay. God bless you for what you
Thank
do,
you, Gloria.
Patrick. You are amazing. I have been catechized by you. And I went to school, and my sister did, from K through 12, Catholic school. And they didn't teach us anything. I mean, I'm 77. Mm-hmm. I knew nothing when I turned 18 and went to college. It was disastrous.
Well, I'm so glad that you listened, Gloria. Thank you.
God bless you for what you do, Patrick. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that very much. Just a reminder, everybody, the Relevant Radio app is free. And wherever you are in the world, and maybe if you have friends and family in other parts of the world, in the Philippines, for example, or Australia or Africa or some other place, text them with the link to the Relevant Radio app, and they could put that on their phones and listen anytime, anywhere in the world. As long as they have an internet connection, they can listen. So let's share Relevant Radio's global network with everybody everywhere. Let's go time-wise. Yeah, we have time. Let's go to Janice in Elk Grove, California. Good morning, Janice.
Good morning. Patrick, I was reading out of 1 Kings today, chapter 18 and chapter 19. There are two references that say, this is when Saul is becoming jealous of David, where it says, an evil spirit sent by God to Saul. And I'm trying to wrap my mind around God sending an evil spirit. Maybe that's my translation, but.
Right. Well, I think that this would fall into the category of God permitting, not so much sending, although it does say that it may not be God sicking a demon on somebody, but rather giving permission for a demon to do what the demon would want to do, but might be held at bay by God, and God relaxing his protection around that person. I'm thinking about Job, for example, in the story of Job, where the devil, at least in this story as it's told, asks God for permission to tempt Job to despair. And God says, okay, go for it. He relaxes whatever maybe shield he had around Job enough so that the devil could do this. Another example would be Satan in the Garden of Eden. God permitted Satan to be there in the Garden of Eden to test Adam and Eve. That wouldn't have happened if God hadn't permitted it. So when I read passages
so
like
testing
this,
Saul, or is it a punishment?
Well, it could be both. It could be either or both. Okay. I mean, Saul was a wicked king, and he met a very grisly end. But God could have been punishing him for this, as well as testing him, or merely testing him. But the way the passage reads in 1 Kings 18 and 19 suggests to me that God was permitting a demon to do this, as opposed to stopping him from doing it.
Okay. All righty. And one just short question. Listening in on your question about moral legislation, can you give me a very simple definition of morality to share with my kids?
Okay, I'll try.
What is morality?
Yeah, morality is our knowledge of the rightness or wrongness of human acts. So a human act does not include burping after a meal or yawning or anything. It's an act that has some moral content to it that you intentionally do or not do. And so morality is our awareness, and it could even be understood to mean like how we have systematized our awareness of things that are right and wrong.
Okay. All righty. Yeah. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate
all right.
It.
Thanks, Janice. Hey, that's a homebrew. It's a homebrew, what's the word I'm looking for? Definition. But I think it's serviceable. Let's see. Let's go to Elias in Lexington, Kentucky. Good morning, Elias. Elias is listening to his radio. See, Elias, that won't work because we're in a delay. So you're listening to me in the past, and I'm talking to you in the future. So, well, actually, at least in the present. So let's see if we can get Elias squared away. We'll come back to him. We'll go now to Paul in Tampa. Good morning, Paul.
Patrick, I've got a question. Thomas the Apostle is my patron.
Okay.
And I know he gets a bad rap as the doubter, but I feel that he also demonstrated a lot of great faith.
Yeah.
On Good Friday, when our Lord was killed, and he indeed did die, how were the 10 notified of this in a convincing manner? And would it have been through John and through the Blessed Mother? Because I know that when Thomas was absent, when Jesus appeared to them after his resurrection, he was so adamant, until I see him, just forget it. I'm not going to believe it. Don't even bother me. Don't get my hopes up.
Right.
So given that amount of conviction on this good man's part, how do you think he came to know, or what was the means that that was conveyed to him or to the 10?
The fact that how was what conveyed to him, that Jesus had died?
The fact that our Lord indeed did die, yeah. Like that would have been conveyed through John and through the Blessed Mother.
Yeah, it seems reasonable to say that for sure, because the Blessed Virgin Mary was there. As you know, St. John was there, St. Mary Magdalene was there, and others as well. Mary, the wife of Cleophas, was there. So these were all close associates of Jesus and the apostles, one of whom was an apostle. So it seems reasonable to me to assume that when they left Calvary, they went back to, maybe they went back to the upper room. It seems like that was their base of operation. So maybe they went back there. And to the extent that any of the other apostles were not standing at a distance and watching this, they would have told them. It seems to me that that's the simplest solution.
That sounds reasonable to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
You got it. I appreciate it. What a interesting question. And when we get to heaven, we'll find out more about things like that. In the meantime, let's take a break and we'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show, including your phone calls. There's still time for you to get in. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Please stay right there. I'm coming right back. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Let's go to Elias now in Lexington, Kentucky. Good morning, Elias.
Peace upon you, Patrick.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have a question for you. I had read the Quran, and it was very interesting reading. There are 25 pages being devoted to Mother Mary and Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is they do believe Jesus Christ was a prophet and his mother Mary was a holy woman. Mm-hmm. And definitely God selected Mother Mary to carry Jesus Christ. But the rest of it, a little bit complicated. Maybe you can explain it to me. My second question, when I speak with my Jewish friend, they do not believe in Jesus Christ at all.
Mm-hmm.
And when I ask him, who was Jesus, the answer they will give me, he was just a Hebrew man, nothing else. Then mm-hmm. I ask, who wrote the Bible then? They still don't answer me. Could you explain that to me, please?
I will try, yes. So it is true, Elias, that in the Quran there are surahs about Mary or Maryam, and they have high regard for her. This is something we can be happy about. It's maybe a little bit of common ground there. So that much is true. You're right about that. Now, the Jewish reaction to Jesus, and by extension to Mary, is largely based upon the Talmud, which is a series of tractates or writings, commentaries by the rabbis going all the way back to the early Middle Ages. And the Talmudic posture, let's say, toward Jesus was very hostile. And so the early rabbis, those who were commenting on Jesus, they did everything they could to try to discredit him. And among the things that they say in some of these tractates are that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was actually raped by a Roman soldier. That's one of the Talmudic claims about Jesus. Some of them say that Jesus was a golem. He was what we might consider something akin to a zombie. You know, a dead person who could fly through the air and do different things. So I would say, without going too deep into this, that a large part of the opposition that people who are Jews today have is a result of what they have been taught all along in their hostility to Jesus. Now, there is a book that I've used before, and I found it very helpful. It's called Refuting Rabbinic Objections to Christianity and Messianic Prophecies. And although it's not focused on Mary, it's a helpful overview of how to respond to the various arguments that are raised by Jews against Jesus as Messiah, and by extension against Mary and her role of salvation. But it really doesn't make much sense to talk to them about Mary if they don't accept Jesus. I would say start with Jesus. So if you want to dig deeper and understand this Talmudic tradition of the rabbis and how they conditioned the Jews to look so poorly, just putting it lightly, upon Jesus, I would start with this book. I think it'll help you.
Mm-hmm. May I suggest something, yeah. Patrick, please?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'm an Assyrian, and I would like you to download or Google Maalula, M-A-A-L-O-U-L-A. It's a village approximately about 30 miles from Damascus. They speak Aramaic. They write Aramaic. They pray in Aramaic.
Okay.
I think there are only about 2,000 of them left. you will be really pleased to listen to the prayer in Aramaic.
Okay. That sounds interesting. I appreciate the tip. And it's good talking to you, Elias. Thank you. Look forward to the next conversation. Let's go now to Juliana in Los Angeles. Good morning, Juliana.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm calling because my sister recently lost her husband, and she's coping with alcohol, which is not coping, but that's what she's experiencing right now.
Yeah.
And it's affecting her daughter's life because sometimes she's not well. And I wanted to know, what is my responsibility as the godmother? We got recently into a big fight over how she was drinking and got mm-hmm. to a family gathering. And we could all tell she had been drinking, and we know she's in a lot of pain. So I'm just concerned for my goddaughter.
Yeah, how old is your goddaughter?
My sister, of course.
Mm-hmm. How old is your goddaughter? Juliana, how old is your goddaughter?
10.
Okay, so she's 10. Well, are you in proximity to her where you could sit down and talk to her face-to-face?
I've tried, and she says she's not having a problem with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And so my other sister tried to talk to her, and they also got in a fight. So we're just trying to love her despite all of this, because this is what she's needing the most.
Yeah.
And she just needs to be really loved, and she's starting to make decisions that are not well for her. So first and foremost, I thought, of course I care about my sister, and I don't want her to make more mistakes. And so...
And how old is she?
I just don't know. She's 38.
Okay. But and she did not exhibit alcoholism as part of her life before this, right? Before she lost her husband?
No.
Okay. So
correct.
This is a cope, like you said, it's a coping mechanism. And
yes.
She could become an alcoholic if she continues going down this road. So you're right to be concerned about her, and that's putting it lightly. So I don't want to discourage you from doing whatever you think is necessary or helpful, especially if it involves protecting this 10-year-old child. So, I mean, hopefully your sister's not driving in the car while she's drunk with her daughter in the car. That would be extremely dangerous. There are intervention techniques that you and your other sisters or whoever else in your family could have an intervention where you confront her. That sometimes is helpful. If you could get her to be willing to go to an AA meeting, that may be a step in the right direction, so that other people with the same difficulty can help her and encourage her and give her a structured place where she can go and start the process. There's a book that you could get her. It's called Dying for a Drink, What You and Your Family Should Know About Alcoholism. And it's a very interesting look at things like trauma and emotional trauma. So losing a husband, of course, would certainly fit that. And in ways in which people who are going down that road can get off, you know, find the off ramp and get off that 8-lane superhighway. So that might be a good book that you could give her, Dying for a Drink. The author's names, by the way, are Anderson Spickard, S-P-I-C-K-A-R-D, and Barbara Thompson. But you can find it easily with that title, Dying for a Drink.
Okay, I'm writing this down. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I think it would be a good book for you to read and your other sister too, so that you've got some informed, you know, knowledge now about the bigger issue. That will help you. Give it to her. Now, I'm thinking about the little girl now, though. So she's 10 years old. That was who I was referring to. And I said, do you live near enough that you could sit down with her? And would you be allowed to?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Would your sister who lost her husband allow you to sit down with her daughter and talk to her maybe when mom's not around to give her some encouragement and direction?
So that was another layer of my question is, would that be okay? She's a young child, and I didn't want to have her feel like she has to be the parent, but I do let her know I love her. So I didn't know to what extent should I bring that layer into that conversation. I can talk to her, but then I didn't know, you know, if my sister would be upset that I talked to her about it. And she's just very on edge about a lot of things that I can only imagine what the pain she's going through, having gone through this so recently.
Oh yeah, she lost her dad. How terrible. Well, the reason I asked about that is because if you can see her face to face and hug her and, you know, show her signs of affection that you're her aunt and her godmother, I think that would go a long way, especially if she's reeling because of her mom being kind of out of control. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the daughter notices that. So that's why I was asking about that. So maybe in a gentle, low-key kind of way, you can let her know, you know, no matter what happens, I'm always here for you. If you ever need to talk, obviously you have to respect your mother. You have to obey your mother. And I'm not here to try to undermine your mother's authority. But while she's going through this difficult time, I realize that maybe you don't feel like you can talk to your mom. I want you to know you can always talk to me and that I love you and I care about you. I think doing that would really help her see, that you're there for her and that you want her well-being. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if she turns to you. And maybe as she gets older, continues to do so, because, wow, my aunt was there for me in a time when I really needed her, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. This is very helpful.
I'm glad.
God bless you.
Yeah, thank you. And prayers for the repose of the soul of your brother-in-law, and my condolences to you and your family.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, Juliana. Thank you. Let's see. That's very difficult. Let's go to Ann in Belgrade, Montana. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. Excuse me. I heard you say earlier that public schools teach the students to hate America.
Yeah.
Maybe I misunderstood, but that's what I thought I heard.
No, you
I've
heard
been
me.
A teacher. I'm retired, but I was a teacher for 40 years all over this country and overseas. And I never heard anyone teach students to hate America. So I'm wondering where you got that information.
Well, part of it is the phenomenon of being a parent of 11 children and seeing what some of them went through in public schools. Now, thankfully, my wife was in a position to be able to homeschool them, so there wasn't much of that. But also anecdotally, in the case of many other families who reached a crisis point because of some of the things that their children were being taught in public schools and then turning to, let's say, Catholic school or even homeschooling. But volumes and volumes have been written about this. Bill Bennett, the former Secretary of Education, under I think it was the first President Bush, if I'm not mistaken, he too, as an authority and an expert on this topic, he spoke widely about this and wrote about it. So it's not that each individual teacher or even necessarily each individual school is guilty of this, but as a general problem, it pervades, as I was saying earlier today, it pervades public education at all levels now. It's gotten much worse in recent years, but there has been a systematic effort to indoctrinate students against what we might consider to be sort of a traditional historical view of the United States. It's definitely ramped up. So it may not have been noticeable or as noticeable when you were teaching. So I don't dispute your own lived experience, far from it. But it really is a problem and a well-documented one. So,
well, I just don't think that it's necessary to generalize on the radio and say something that's inflammatory.
Well, I do think so, Anne. I disagree with you respectfully on this issue. And first of all, if anything, you're taking the opposite approach and you're personalizing something and saying that because it wasn't in your experience, therefore it doesn't exist. That's the opposite of what I'm doing. What I'm saying is that, sure, there are people like you who maybe were very good teachers and very conscientious and very appropriate in what you taught. But that doesn't negate the fact that there are plenty of others who are doing exactly the opposite of that. So the curricula in the public schools for a long time has been a problem for many parents. And you'll see, if you just go on YouTube, look up the instances of parents speaking out about these problems at PTA meetings, at school board meetings and things. And there are countless examples of this all around the country. And these are the parents who have to deal with the kids who are coming home and telling the stories of what they're learning in school. So it may be inflammatory, but it's not not gratuitous. It's shining a light on a real problem that we have in this country. Anyway, thank you, Anne. Appreciate your phone call, even though we don't agree on this, but thank you. Let's go to Joan in Santa Clarita, California. Good morning, Joan.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've been listening to your show now for several months.
60 seconds.
Oh, okay. So do you have anything that you can recommend for new Catholics, like basic,
I do.
What do Catholics believe and Bible history?
I do. I've got a bunch of things I could recommend, but why don't you start with this particular book? I wrote it. If you don't mind, I'll tell you about my book. It's called Now What? Sure. A Guide to the Catholic Church for New and Not So New Catholics. And it was my effort to speak to exactly this question that you're asking. Now that you're Catholic, now that you're in, now what? What do you do next? And how do you make sense out of all this stuff? So that was my effort to, in book form, answer your question. Okay.
Awesome. Thank you so much. What about Bible history? Like, who wrote it and when?
Oh, wonderful. I would say Introduction to the Bible by Father Ken Baker, published by Ignatius Press. Excellent one-volume focus on every book of the Bible. Very helpful.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Joan. I wish we had more time, but call me next time and we'll maybe spend a bit more time as we can. Until next time, thank you for listening and God bless you. Please pray for me. I'll pray for you. Thank you, Cyrus. You're a genius.